You're listening to the Innovation in Healthcare podcast, produced by Health Innovation Northeast and Northumbria, proudly improving health and care for everyone. In this episode, we present our Digital Inclusion Forum. Our Digital Transformation Director, Dave Belshaw, leads a conversation between our chair, Professor Dean Fathers, and Baroness Hilary Armstrong, member of the House of Lords, who chairs the government's Digital Inclusion Action Committee. They explore how the government's Digital Inclusion Action Plan is being rolled out, and why it is more important than ever to ensure that no one is left behind.
My name is Dave Belshaw. We have two special guests this afternoon. We have Baroness Armstrong, who I will ask to introduce herself shortly, and Professor Dean Fathers. We've been running the Digital Inclusion Forum for about 4 years now. And today, very much the focus is around what is the national direction of travel around digital inclusion, and how can we then think about supporting that? So without further ado, I'm going to ask Baroness Armstrong initially to introduce herself, a little bit about her role and experience, and why digital inclusion matters to her. Then we'll introduce Dean, and then we'll talk about the Inclusion Action Plan. Baroness Armstrong.
Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Hilary Armstrong. I was born and brought up in the Northeast, lived in the Northeast most of my life. I worked in Newcastle and Sunderland until I became a Member of Parliament in 1987, which is still quite a long time ago. Many of you won't even have been born then. I represented Northwest Durham when the pits and the steelworks had closed. And I worked in Sunderland when the shipyards were closing. And I worked as a community and youth worker and taught at the Poly in Sunderland on community and youth work. So I've always been involved in how do we actually make sure that people in the Northeast are able to get the very best and are able to develop the skills that I know are there, the capacity that I know is there, but that actually we often think, oh, you know, they don't quite have the brains that everybody else, because we were a manufacturing region where everything was based around that manufacturing work, really. So anyway, we've moved on from then. I've now been in the House of Lords. I was in the last Labour government and did social exclusion, but I was also government chief whip for 5.5 years. So, you know, I've had an interesting career. And I'm now in the House of Lords. And my last job in the last government was in the Cabinet Office, social exclusion. And one of my SPADs, my special advisors, was Peter Kyle. And so when he was Secretary of State, he came to me with one of his now SPADs, who'd been my SPAD, and had actually, I'd recruited him from North Tyneside. And they said to me, we need somebody to do something for us on digital inclusion. We need somebody who's older, who's not from London, who's not tech, you know, who's not a techie, but who knows about people and public services and those people who need the services but often can't afford and access them. And they said, we both thought of you. So, you know, that's me. I'm not a techie, but I do know, and I've spent much of my career working with the most excluded, working with, you know, I was part of setting up the very first refuge in the Northeast in Sunderland many, many years ago. And I've been involved a lot around social exclusion. And for me, this agenda, digital inclusion, is all about making sure that the folk I know and have worked with are not left behind, are not ignored in the drive and the rapid change that there is in how the internet works, in how services work and use digital means. And the reality is that is going to grow much more quickly in the future. It is inevitable. And we have to make sure that the range of people who are disadvantaged in terms of access and affordability and safety on the internet, that we actually open things up. So the government produced a year ago their Digital Inclusion Action Plan. And that action plan included setting up a Digital Inclusion Action Committee. And that is what I chair. And it's got people on from the industry, people on from the voluntary and charitable sector, local government people. There are the Minister for Digital Inclusion, obviously comes under Liz Kendall, and I talked at length to her yesterday about the agenda because we've got a meeting tomorrow. But the Minister actually is Liz Lloyd, who is in the House of Lords, and she chairs a cross-government ministerial committee looking at these issues. And the four priority areas for the action plan were improving digital skills, tackling barriers to data and device affordability, ensuring digital public services are accessible, and building people's confidence online. And I would add to all of those, doing that in a way that people can have confidence that it's safe. The number of older folk I've met as I've been going around looking at this around the country and talking to people in homes, the number of older people who say, my kids won't let me go on the internet because they think I'll be scammed. So, you know, I know safety is an important matter too, but so is easy, straightforward accessibility. There is a committee in the Treasury which is looking at digital inclusion for banking and so on. And I have met with them, and they are working on how they can get a platform that goes across different apps, but which uses a simple and straightforward access, which again has got safety built in. And I think, we haven't yet got there, but I think that we need a similar access for public services so that we're not getting a different one for health. You know, one of the problems in health is everybody who's doing, for example, patient records has a different system. And so getting them to talk to each other is a nightmare. We've got to, you know, the government has got to tackle that. The NHS has got to tackle that. And that's not what I'm talking about, although the implication is that it needs to be tackled in order to allow older folk, people with disabilities, people who are in employment, young people who are NEETs, they need to have this easy access and the affordability. And there are lots of different systems going on around the country. I'll be in Sunderland again on Friday, looking at neighbourhoods, because I'm doing work on neighbourhoods as well as digital inclusion. And in Sunderland, they've done loads of work on digital inclusion and on spreading the accessibility of the people of Sunderland throughout the city into access. And of course, it's particularly useful for things like social care. You know, we just got to catch up with this, and we've got to be sure that we're letting everybody build the confidence. Now, one of the ways will be developing people in every locality who are trusted volunteers, because there are some people who will not be able to do any of this on their own. And we'll need a trusted volunteer. But that's why I'm working with Age Concern. I talked to somebody from the Red Cross who's doing all their community piloting around the country at the moment. I talked to her this weekend. We need to be working with those people who are developing volunteers who can help people in the local hubs, or indeed, if they can help the carers of people who are in their home, to know what they need to do to give the individuals in the home access. So there are a range. This cannot be just done by the state on its own. So I say to you health people, it cannot just be done by the NHS on its own. The NHS has got to engage with the voluntary and community sector, as well as local government, to actually transform the accessibility, the opportunities for people in their own, wherever they are, where they are, and where they're comfortable. But it does mean we have to get them devices. So there is, as part of the whole thing, making devices available to people. You can't really be a patient these days comfortably without having access to the internet. And if you've got an iPad that you can also connect to your grandkids with, then you need to be able to know and have the confidence about talking to your GP or talking to another part of the health service on a device. So we do have a system where the government is encouraging devices to be handed in, where they'll be repurposed. There is a, you know, there's a whole program for that. And then the voluntary sector also have their own programs, and indeed private sector, some members of the industry have taken up the challenge of this too. So again, we're saying to the health service, they need to be part of how are their kit, what are they doing in that kit when they finished with it? Are they handing it in so that it can be repurposed and used by people in a hub or whatever? So that's one of it, but also very good basic training courses that the voluntary sector have developed. An organization called Good Things Foundation, they have a very good, straightforward course, and that can happen. But, you know, we just got to get on top of this. So what we in the committee are doing are looking at the critical issues that are coming up in the different subcommittees, and then at the main committee, we are thinking about how we move forward on that. So we're looking at affordability. What does that mean across the board? We're looking at whether there should be targets for the number of devices that we're looking to get repurposed every year. We're looking at things like, how do we actually make sure that there's going to be digital switchover of television? That would be a real challenge for some people, because it will mean a new television. It will mean using apps in order to do what they've just been used to doing, one switch on. So, you know, and there's a lot of anxiety about that, but it's going to happen. So it's our job to actually advise the government about what that might entail and how long they should do it. And I see the committee as being how we make sure that this agenda is not neglected in any government department, that we, in a sense, we can be the allies. We can say what sometimes the government isn't ready to say, but we can say, this is the sort of thing you need to be working on. We can be really pushing the agenda forward. And I think that's what ministers want from me. Because as I say, I'm not a techie, but I do know the sort of problems that people out there will have. And we do work with people who do understand how you plan a programme in the digital world so that it will actually deliver something in however many years' time. And we do have people who work with us who know very, very well the numbers of people that are involved and the way in which you can begin to shift and give the industry confidence in investing what's going to be needed for this agenda for the future. So I can talk forever, but I'm going to shut up now. please call me Hillary. I'm not a tech expert, but I am meeting lots of tech experts. And I'm also talking to people in the NHS about the agenda on neighbourhood health. And, you know, we are working together how we persuade the NHS that this has to be a bottom-up thing and that digital inclusion is going to be very important in it. And it may well be we'll have to have digital inclusion hubs in neighbourhood centres, health neighbourhood health centres. But we all have to work together to make sure that the people in neighbourhoods, even if they're a bit bigger for the health service than they are for my regeneration programme, but nevertheless, all of those people feel that they are not excluded from the basic services that we all need in order to live in the 21st century.
Thank you, Hillary. I'm going to ask Dean in a second to introduce himself as well and think about in his experiences and reflections on digital inclusion generally. And then I wonder if we could come back to maybe the four key areas that you touched on in terms of improving digital skills, reducing barriers to data-run devices, product services which are accessible for everyone, and then building online confidence. And maybe take each one of those areas and think through what are the thoughts of the committee, but then also Dean and myself, we've probably got some real life examples and some thoughts that we could bring out in each of those areas of work that's actually happening both locally and nationally. But I'll come to Dean now and just say, Dean, could you please just introduce yourself, your background a little bit on your interest in digital inclusion.
So thank you, Dave. So Dean Fathers, I'm very privileged to be the chair of the Health Innovation Network for the North East. But as we have already identified, we're one of 15 that covers the whole of England. And of course, this is something which is a UK-wide conversation. So we're very keen to actually make sure that we're in the North East engaging with the other nations as well. I have to agree with Hillary. I'm not a technologist either. In fact, my wife describes me as a technoprat, in that if a digital technology can be broken, it's me that can break it. And consequently, I'm at the kind of leading edge of not understanding why people want things, and therefore design is something that I get very interested in. Innovation is something I get very interested in. And improvement is something I'm very interested in. I actually came to digital inclusion not through digital. I came to it originally through the inclusion, equality and diversity agenda. So obviously digital inclusion, Hillary has picked up upon older people very much so in her introduction, but people with mental health, people with learning disabilities, people who have got challenges in their life because of low income, people who have got English is not their first language, people who are from places of low economic kind of prosperity. That inequality agenda is something that I've been really hot on over my 30 odd years in business. I've looked at that from within the NHS, so I've been privileged to chair a number of NHS organisations over the last 25 years. I've looked at that from the third sector, where I've been privileged to be trustees of a variety of charities associated with deaf communities or people with learning disabilities or veterans, for instance, who have been involved with the judicial system. So all of those are people that need to be considered in regards to digital inclusion. But I came to digital latterly through my commercial world. So clearly, as the world is changing, digital is becoming much more important to us. Digital is becoming more important in terms of our back office functions, making sure that we're efficient and productive. It's more important to us in our ability to be more productive, to deal with patient outcomes. And it's also more important to us because it enables us to use the technology to take data in whether it be a large or small language model to do better analytics so that we can get better innovation and drive better research for the benefit of improving patient outcomes.
Thank you, Dean. Your reflections in each of the key theme areas that Hilary alluded to earlier. And the first one is around thinking about how we improve digital skills. So in the North East North Cumbria, the work that we've done on digital inclusion, we think about digital skills or digital inclusion as being part of a triangle. And in each corner, you have a device. Do you have access to an appropriate device? Connectivity, can that device be connected and can you connect up to what you need to do? But then in the third corner is around skills. And actually, do you have the skills to use that device in a way that connects you with healthcare? And often I found myself having conversations with people where they said, no, I can't use this. I can't, you know, go online and book my appointments and this and that. And they're saying, well, but can you go online and can you buy yourself something at Argos? Or can you do your Tesco shop? Or you know, can you have a Teams call with your family or a WhatsApp call? And often people will have those skills. They just don't necessarily see them as transferable. But then I'll also use my mum, who will never forgive me if she finds out, as an example. And my mum can't send a text on her 1980s Nokia. But my in-laws, who are a very similar age, have lots of Apple devices and edit their own home movies. So I think we're on a plane where we think about skills. We need to think about skills on an individual level rather than trying to put people into categories or groups. But I don't know what your thoughts were, Hilary, on the work of the committee in terms of improving digital skills. What areas are you focusing on? And then maybe a question or two or some reflections from Dean.
Okay, yeah. Well, obviously, as we go around looking at things in hubs, we are finding that, you know, it's like anything else. Anybody who has done teaching or development work or whatever, you know what the first thing you have to do is find the motivation. And you find the motivation, and then you can work with people around the specific that you need to actually change what they're trying to do. So I've been to hubs where there are a number of people who English is not their first language. I went to a hub in Sheffield that had started as essentially an English as a second language unit. You know, there was a shop with a mother and a daughter, both of whom were English graduates. The mother had retired. The daughter didn't know quite what she wanted to do, but had enjoyed some work with teaching English as a second language. And her mother bought the shop and they created this hub. And of course, digital inclusion became important because it was based in the area of Sheffield where most migrants ended up. So when the Ukrainians arrived, when the people from Hong Kong, when people from Afghanistan arrived, they would be forwarded to this hub to make sure they got support on their English as a second language. And then they were moved into digital inclusion. And in digital inclusion, the mother said, we soon understood that some of them were very good at it. So I met an Afghani guy who had come over and had worked for the British Army in Afghanistan, and he was good at digital skills, And he had become a community champion on digital skills. So they sent him round other digital hubs in libraries in Sheffield. And the main thing was he now got a flat in one of these areas that was a white working class area. And he said he was a bit anxious because, you know, he knew they didn't really approve of migrants because there was lots of flags up. But he was able, because he'd made the contacts with people around helping them to get onto the internet, whether that was to talk to their grandchildren, to talk to the school, to talk to the NHS, whatever it was, he was helping them do that. And the people who ran the hub had helped him do a bit more. And he said, it's great. They don't treat me as if I'm a migrant anymore. and he's very happy living there. And so it's about finding the motivation and then finding things that people will be able to, that are in their comfort zone, in a sense. And for a lot of the people I've met in hubs, they've been lonely. They've not known who they can talk to about their problems. And they go to a hub, or they're taken to a hub, and they find other people to talk to. But then they get the skill development. And for some of them, it's never going to be what you and I would call, you know, they're not going to pass an exam in it. But they have enough to do what they need to do. And they also have somebody there as a friend they can call on to help them. And our view as a committee is we have got to find the different ways. I mean, I've had a colleague talk to me about his brother who's got learning difficulties and can't read. And trying to get the health service to talk to him on a device rather than send him a text is his big issue. And we have to be able to personalise things, but that means the health service and other services need to be able to respond to those individual needs. And I do think that neighbourhood health is going to be the key to that. And then the work in the rest of the health service to get different systems talking to each other so that they can respond in a personalised way.
Thank you. I think it's interesting that you pick out the issue around digital inclusion for all, but then that additional need for some of our more marginalised communities. One of our digital inclusion forums recently, we had a lady who is hearing impaired, who talked about her experiences of trying to access health services generally, but also talked about from a digital point of view. How difficult that was. Dean, any reflections on that in terms of skills building? I know there's been one or two local projects that we've had, and on or maybe wider experiences.
I think there's several, if I may. So I think again, Hilary picks up rightly. You know, this isn't about passing qualifications. This is about learning things which are relevant to your life, and therefore. Yeah. Making sure that because it's relevant to your life, you've got to have something which is empathetic to your personal needs. One of my frustrations, for instance, personally, is when I ask my AI friend on my phone for something, it gives me a generic answer, which it's trawled from large data sets, which isn't the actual answer that I want. Because it doesn't listen to my specific needs. It assumes that I'm looking for something it wants to give me. And so how do we change the technology to enable me to have what I need as opposed to what it wants to feed me become something which is a future element of our inclusive nature? I think one of the things that I've learned from equality and diversity and why digital is around giving equity of access to all is that if you are somebody who is looking around, say, for instance, the example you gave, Dave, where one member of your family isn't a Silver Surfer, but another member of your family is, people look to the generation around them for role models, people like me. And so if they can find people like me who can demonstrate what they've done and how they've gone through it, that gives me confidence that I can do it too. So how can we promote those champions? How can we raise those, the profile of those, and get them engaged in the local activities? Again, as Hilary points out, with that individual, great championing is what's needed. But one of the things that, if I can share with you, what I'm doing in a church community around me, is that we're doing reverse mentoring. Yeah. So we've got the people who've got the life skills that have come from my generation, you know, who've learned how to do things with their hands that are not digital, or crafts which are not digital, trading those skills with the younger people in the community who are digital to help them to understand what to do. And that's dealing with some of the loneliness issues that, again, Hilary rightly picked out. It's getting people into a community where they feel safe and respected. And because they feel respected, they're prepared to take the risks that are associated with learning. And because the person is doing the reverse mentoring is also taking the risk of learning, neither of them feel vulnerable. So how do we create those spaces that are safe psychologically, where that vulnerability is no longer an issue and prevents them from getting into that learning zone mentally?
That's great. Thank you. Thank you for that. And I'm going to bring it back to the second theme of the committee, Hilary, which was around reducing barriers to data devices. Now, we tried to do quite a lot of work on that in the Northeast North Cymru. We've got a couple of projects for young people with diabetes, where those young people and their families have been gifted repurposed devices in order that they can access elements of their care. And also in one of our South Tyneside and Sunderland Foundation Trusts, you alluded to Sunderland earlier, and they've been donating devices to their dialysis patients in order to get access. So we've got some small examples of that, but where we have struggled is then trying to convert that into something that we can do at scale that would really benefit our citizens. These days it would seem that our trusts are more and more under financial pressure. Their devices are being used for longer, there's less of them being repurposed. So just wondering around what in particular the committee might be looking at, and then Dean, again, some reflections on how do we start to think about data and devices in terms of making sure our community is not left behind.
Okay, there is a national scheme. That is dealing with, there's a challenge to every government department. We do have targets for that. And this year, of course, because Microsoft are changing all its, its programs, a lot of devices are going to become redundant quickly. And we need to make sure we get those in. Good things and others in the third sector have got a national scheme, and they too are doing that and are pushing things back into the hubs. It's a big issue for young people who are neat, not in employment, education or training, or even, I've talked to Sunderland University, and they know, because they've got the highest number of local students in attendance, that they have students who don't have a device at home or Wi-Fi at home. And the council has got their own app, which means you can get Wi-Fi anywhere in the city, whoever you are. If you log on to the app. But the university knows they have students in the library and in their and whatever for longer, because the students don't have a device. So we have to think about what is the position of that individual and what is it they need, and how do we actually, in the way that gives them least distress, make something accessible and affordable. And the committee has got all sorts of ideas on this. And as I say, if we get on and do switch over of televisions, that will be another way in which you can get some access. But there are various ways, and we have to do it, both in terms of devices, but also in terms of data. And there are companies who will give data. I mean, there's a relationship between the Trussell Trust and the food banks, and I think it's Tesco. And Tesco will give their Wi-Fi devices. They'll give their data, their SIM cards. They'll give SIM cards. And there's a lot of places where you can get a SIM card with a limited amount of data for the week, the month on it. And the use of that has gone up exponentially. And we have to do that. And the as I say, the government is not even the appropriate agency for that. We are talking to them both about social, we will be talking to them about social tariffs, but also about other methods. If you take digital inclusion as an essential service in a household, in the way water and electricity is, then the government has to think, how do we make sure for those who haven't got access, we get them access? And there are various different ways that we as a committee will be saying to the government they need to think about. But that is where it is, that actually I say you have to think about it as a utility. And some people say, oh, that's a bit crude. A special service, some people call it, or something. But I don't care what you call it. It is something that everybody now needs access to in some way.
I think that's a great thought, actually, in terms of thinking as a, in terms of an essential service. And there is already, you know, many people have smart meters these days, and there is already digital access to many people's homes that we're simply not using appropriately, or not using in a way that we could do. Dean, I wonder if you had any thoughts on the area of data and devices.
I'm going to take some international examples, if I may. So the first one is a bit of a caveat that was given to me on Saturday morning when I was having a conversation with a colleague of mine over in Dubai. He was basically sharing the fact that his organization, which is a global organization, had just tried to put in an order for several thousand pieces of hardware from a multinational supplier, and was basically told, we haven't got the chips for that many. We are, you know, therefore not going to be able to deliver on that order. And so the capacity that we are creating is not growing as fast as the demand.
Yeah.
And therefore we maybe need to think about a new paradigm as to how we do this. So going back to, you know, IBM's, you know, starting this journey off, they thought there was going to be five big supercomputers around the world. Microsoft changed that to everybody has a laptop on their, you know, desk at home. What's the next paradigm, and how does that paradigm shape? And so the richness of thinking differently will give us new opportunities. So when you go to places like Nigeria, I do a lot of work with Nigerian organizations. They have got more digital devices per head of population than anywhere else in the world.
Absolutely.
But they don't have the infrastructure that we've got that have prevented them from being the norm that we've got, and they've leapfrogged ahead.
Yep.
Lithuania is another example with a different paradigm, using digital devices and technology to democratize their health system, to get the population to buy into what it is that they get as the benefits from controlling their own technology and controlling the system. And Hillary has rightly again pointed out about how under old infrastructure models, we protect entry and exit points for data. If you democratize this, take it to the ultimate paradigm, then that will no longer be the case. And if you go to India, one of the places I'm privileged to be on the advisory group for the University of Delhi's Center for Social Enterprise and Innovation, they're working heavily on building social enterprise models which build innovation. So if you go to a 5G mast in certain parts of India, you will find there a power kiosk that anybody can access, and you will get free use of all the hardware, technology, software you need, and you can do everything you want. So new paradigms are potentially what we're needing to think about, especially when it comes to rural and coastal communities. So much of our infrastructure is based around urban models. We need to be thinking about how we actually create new models that are based on rural and coastal community norms, where people are physically prevented from getting quick access to places like libraries or wherever, because their geography is, not as close.
It's interesting that you talk about those, Susie. I like the concept of that digital bank, and also mentioned libraries, as of course for many years our local authorities have developed digital spaces in public spaces such as libraries. And there you can get access to equipment and connectivity, and someone will help you if required. What's often lacking, of course, in those spaces is any confidential space. So if you need to engage in a health conversation, you don't necessarily want to have that, with someone else sat either side of you doing their thesis research or their online shopping. So it's trying to get that balance right, isn't it? So one of the things that has come up, and it comes from my third point, Hillary, if I may, which is around public services, which are accessible for all, the third theme of the committee. We've had the NHS app for around 8 years or so now, 6 to 8 years or so now, and it's still only available in one language. So actually, we've got some distance to travel. So I'm wondering what the thoughts of the committee were in terms of how we make sure our public services are accessible in a digital age.
That is the big challenge. And the truth is that too often it has been convenient for services to say, oh, we can't do digital because the patients, a GP practice I came across, we can't do digital because our patients can't all use the internet. And rather than, there is a bit of a challenge here, we're going to have to work out with people, with the local authority, with other voluntary organisations, how we do this. That is the clue to what I really want to say, is that services need to understand they're part of something bigger than just that. The determinants of health are more than who your doctor is. It is what your housing's like, what your attitude to your own health is, what your it's a whole raft of things. And any service has to understand what is happening to the person that they're trying to deal with in the context that they're in. I've spent a lot of my professional life working with people who are socially excluded. I was 10 years involved with Changing Lives in the Northeast, and still I'm sort of involved with them. And with each of those individuals, there are different ways that they will come to be involved. And we in the public sector have to be able to adjust the way we do things to actually enable them to be engaged. That is what the ministerial committee is about. So that in each department you're thinking, what are the issues here? What are the issues here that can then be translated hub through the app, whichever service you're involved with? I'm not too worried about the NHS app only being in English. The key is to help somebody who has not got English as a second language to improve their English so that they're able to communicate with the people who will help them change their opportunities, whichever service they're going into. I've always said we should be, everybody who comes to this country to live, within 2 years, they should be able to be confident in their English. That's part of our responsibility in the public sector, quite honestly. And it's what was recommended in the report on integration to Theresa May, however many years it is since she was Prime Minister. And we just haven't done it. And actually, if you talk to the people who generate the app, the NHS app, there are amazing groups of people who use the app who do that because they're either scared to go or their grouping is in difficulties with the formal systems. I'm not going to go into that in any great depth today. But we have to understand where people are and what access they need. And, you can't expect every school. They will have translation. I mean, and translation is a big issue, and it's a big issue in the health service and a big issue in other public services. And I want services to have translation more available. But I also want people who come here to be more able themselves to be in control of what's happening to them. Now, we have to make sure that wherever the hub is, there are people there, and wherever the individual is, there are people who are near enough to help them actually manage this and navigate it, and to do that in a way that they feel confident in and they trust them. And we just have a long way to go on this. And it's no good every service thinking they have the answers and they don't need to talk to others. I can tell you one of my committee's anxieties is that health service, digital services, they don't talk to anybody else. They only talk to the health service. And I know there's a lot to do in the health service. However, unless they talk to the others, we'll not tackle people's health.
It's one of those few areas where the emergence of AI and technology layered upon technology, and that AI does a reasonably good at translating most things, I think. And the communications lead sat next to me has just said, actually, the best thing we can do is make everything available in good English, because good English is much easier to translate.
Absolutely.
That's maybe one of the things that we could look at, and then almost rely on our technology to make the technology more available through translation services. Dean, any thoughts on that?
Just want to add an extra. I mean, translation services are absolutely essential, but not all languages are oral. So deaf, British Sign Language is not an oral language, and therefore technology is able to create signing within the media that we've got available to us nowadays. One of the interesting things that I discovered, there's a brilliant byproduct of a NASA innovation, which was designed to communicate between humans on Mars when we eventually get humans on Mars back with the kind of the planet Earth, which basically allows a time lag between the sending of data and the returning of the communication. And they've generated a thing called Braided on the back of that, which means that people who are neurodiverse are able now to communicate differently in a tool that enables them to have better communication. So neurodiversity is another example where we need to be thinking, not everybody is neurotypical. And therefore, digital inclusion is about dealing with those neurodiverse needs as well.
Yep.
And technology can be created to enable that community to work effectively. So how do we use technology for that purpose? I think the interesting thing is, whilst it's been around the NHS app for a long time, not everybody has got it. There are some issues. There was an example of one particular person in my community who discovered that they'd got a stage 4 cancer diagnosis from the app before the GP had actually managed to break the news. So there has got some issues around the way that we use that app currently. But I think as a technology, it's a great communications media. What it does is it sends out information. What it doesn't do is pull in information. And I think communication is always better when it's two ways. And therefore, how do we input more to the NHS app? How do we get the person who knows my body best, me, to be able to let people know how I'm feeling, what my vital signs are today, what my medication might have been, done today, or whatever? How do I get me more engaged in that technology so that the system can get better use of it? And that's therefore a measure of trust again. And so I'm curious to know whether Hillary has kind of got thoughts about how trust is displayed. Both you started off talking about, the psychological safe space at the beginning, and do I trust people not to scam me? But what's the message that the public are getting from people who are saying, we don't trust you to have control of your own data, we will have control and we'll only share it with you when we think you're capable of dealing with it? So there's big trust communication message that needs to start to be thought about as well, I think.
I talk about trusted volunteers who are not necessarily employed in the state services, because a lot of people don't trust the statutory services. A lot of the people that I've worked with, women who've been abused, etc., and that's a big issue with digital stuff, because they're tracked by the perpetrators. And so we're working with the industry to find ways of making sure that you can have alternative devices that can't be tracked. But anyway, that's another debate. It is important in this space. But it really is, how do we make sure that, what I was going to say was, a lot of those women are terrified that if they tell anybody anything, they'll have their kids removed. And it's, how do we actually get somebody who trusts, but also knows where the barriers need to be, where they've got to actually protect things or children or whatever in the midst of chaos that's going on. I live with trying to work out how to get people to trust things day in and day out. And for all of us, that's an issue. And it has to be around people who we can rely on and who are there time and time again for us. And once they are, then people trust them. And the same goes for how we work with them. If we don't trust them to actually take control of their lives and their health, they will never be healthy, because you can't do it all in the health service.
It was interesting there, I think, talking about building confidence, and I'm going to come into that last bit, is building confidence online. And I just wanted to, it's similar along the lines that we've just been having a conversation. Our colleagues in Yorkshire and Humber Health Innovation Network had a project in partnership with Virgin Media and O2, where anyone going into their stores was also offered some education and training on the NHS app. So they were going in there with the purpose of, getting a new phone or talking about their whatever. But as part of the Virgin Media's staff social value, they agreed to contribute a day a month of their time to train members of the public around the NHS app. So that's an area where you wouldn't necessarily expect that kind of conversation to be happening, but it's a great opportunity for non-NHS engagement around the NHS app to say, have you got it downloaded on your phone? Do you know how to use it? Would you like me just to walk you through, you know, what it can do, what it can't? And more of that kind of partnership, I think, could really go a long way. So thinking along those lines, and the last area of the committee, Hilary, if I may, was around building confidence online.
I think that what you're talking about there, and the example you give is a very good one of how you do that. And I, as I say, have this vision that basically in a hub, whether the hub's in a library linked or linked to the community centre or linked to the neighbourhood health centre or linked to the food bank, a lot of them are linked to food banks, there is somebody there who the health service have trained so that they do know how to get in and how to reassure people about keeping their data private, and so on and so forth, but that you have people who can work with them. And you know, I've done work with Tesco's and so on in the past in different circumstances around this. We got them in the Northeast, actually, when I was involved in running a sports organisation, to get people to volunteer from the shop to help out in training of kids in sports. So not so that they became elite sport, but just so they got active. And, you know, we supported the volunteers. And then actually they came and volunteered at other things like the Great North Run and things through having volunteered just to help out at their local school or whatever. So it's thinking in a more creative way about how you use staff, how you engage with organisations that are not yours necessarily, but how you then link them into the things that your organisation knows about and does day in and day out.
Thank you, Hilary. Dean, any reflections?
I mean, I love your example, Dave. I think it's a great example of good corporate social responsibility. And, you know, we have a history in this country of being a society that cares, that develops collaborations and partnerships. I think the building of social capital that you've identified there is essential to what we're doing. And so, you know, there are a number of examples in the Northeast where that exactly has been done. You know, the Breaking Barriers Initiative in Whitehaven, or Hilary mentioned earlier, you know, Sunderland Council working with volunteers and developing smart city, etc. You know, that's something we've got to start to think about. How do we build that greater collaboration between? And one of the things that I'm keen that we as a health innovation network do through things like our pledge is we bring all of those partners together, that we actually create the space for people to collaborate, to communicate with each other, and to celebrate what's really good around digital inclusion. And so, you know, we're a partner where we want to champion and provide allyship to all of those stakeholders, but also to enable those stakeholders to reach into those communities that we serve. And we think, importantly, in the way that those communities want us to think, we're empathetically engaged, not just communicating with them. So how do we engage them and bring them in so that they can share with us their real thoughts, and then we can create our new paradigm? And it's that new paradigm that I think has got to be developed, going back to what I said earlier. If we can generate that through collaboration, then we'll move ahead at pace.
I'd like to thank Dean. And I'd also like to thank Hilary for giving up her time. We have another Digital Inclusion Forum, not till the end of April. Monday the 27th, and the link for that is below. The focus of that one, I believe, is going to be on research and academic studies into digital inclusion, and we've got some local academics coming forward to tell us about some of the research they've been doing and some of the learning they've been achieving with some local projects for that. Thank you all ever so much again.
You have been listening to the Innovation in Healthcare podcast, produced by Health Innovation Northeast and Northumbria. If you'd like to find out more about our digital transformation programmes, you can visit the Driving Digital Transformation section on our website at healthinnovationnenc.org.uk. We will, of course, provide further links and resources in the podcast show notes. Thank you for listening.